I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me today is Jacob Murdoch, Executive Director of the Nevada Chapter of the National Hemophilia Foundation, or NHF. Jacob previously held management positions with the Mob Museum and the United Way of Southern Nevada, as well as working in higher education at UNLV and the University of Arkansas. The NHF's 8th annual Winter Wine Fest is coming up at the end of the month for the first time since the pandemic. Jacob, thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on today, Heather.
So what exactly does the National Hemophilia Foundation do?
Great question. The National Hemophilia Foundation, and specifically our chapter, the Nevada chapter, work with over 700 families throughout the state of Nevada who have an inherited bleeding disorder. And so the one that we commonly think of is hemophilia. That's not the most common bleeding disorder, but it is the one that's the most popular. But what we do is we provide program services, education, support for those families who have inherited bleeding disorders.
What is the most prevalent bleeding disorder if it's not hemophilia?
The most prevalent is called von Willebrand disease, and it impacts 1 to 2% of the population nationwide.
So what's the difference? I mean, I know hemophilia is a lack of clotting. So basically, the person who has hemophilia is going to bleed out if they don't have the right medication because there's no clotting mechanism. What's the difference with the other one?
So essentially all inherited bleeding disorders, or at least most of the inherited bleeding disorders, including hemophilia and von Willebrand's disease, they are a lack of a certain protein that your body would normally produce that helps your blood clot. And so really the difference between the different types of hemophilia and von Willebrand disease are the different type of protein. So I think there's 13 different proteins that help your blood clot. And so it's depending on which one your body lacks is essentially which one of the bleeding disorders you may have. There's also some very rare bleeding disorders that are a little bit different, but essentially all of them have the commonality is that your body lacks a protein that allows your blood to clot normally.
Okay. So when was the National Hemophilia Foundation first started and also the Nevada chapter?
So the National Hemophilia Foundation is actually celebrating our 75th anniversary this year in 2023. Wow. And then the Nevada chapter specifically, we started in the 1990s. And so we just celebrated a couple years ago our 30th anniversary. And then we became a part of the National Hemophilia Foundation in 2011. So the organization was here existing prior to joining with the National Hemophilia Foundation.
Okay, nice. So what services and resources are available for those with bleeding disorders?
Absolutely. So we provide a lot of different things. So we provide education services. So some of those are directly related to bleeding disorders. Say your doctor just diagnoses you or one of your children with a bleeding disorder. We provide education for you to better understand about your bleeding disorder and understand, you know, what it is, what you may be in for with that. We also provide education for things that are connected to having a bleeding disorder. For example, you know, how to get accommodations with your school or with your child's school. We also provide education on things like mental health, on pain management, things that are, you know, not specific to an individual bleeding disorder, but kind of apply to, you know, if you have a bleeding disorder, these things apply to you. We also provide financial assistance. So bleeding disorders are one of the most expensive chronic conditions to treat. And so a lot of our families don't have money for things that we may take for granted being able to purchase or to have. And so we provide financial assistance for folks if they are struggling to pay for basic necessities or for their medication or other things in life. We also help provide counseling assistance. So if somebody would like to get some counseling services, we can provide them a referral and pay for counseling for them or their children or another family member. And then we also provide social outlets and activities for folks to do. So in a safe environment, right? So somebody with a bleeding disorder, you have to worry about hurting yourself and getting a bleed. So we provide a safe environment to do social activities. Like last year, we had an axe throwing event. So we went to one of the local axe throwing places here in Las Vegas and, you know, provided a safe, fun environment for people just to hang out. They got a little bit of education beforehand and then spent a couple hours eating and throwing axes. We also do camp programs. So, you know, we have the ability to send teenagers on a river rafting trip, which we'll have teens go on in the summer. So really kind of a lot of different things that we provide. We basically do all of the things outside of medical treatment. And so, you know, and like I said, we do stuff all over the state. So we serve families in every corner of Nevada, not just Southern Nevada.
Okay. Now, axe throwing sounds like it could go the wrong way. So I'm glad there were no mishaps there.
Absolutely. And we always make sure to take as many safety precautions as we can. And things like camp, or, you know, we'll always have a medical professional, a nurse that will be there with us, that both there to, you know, help in case there's any sort of mishaps, but also to help administer medication. And one of the things that we do at our camp programs and our teen programs is help educate young people how to medicate themselves. They have to infuse their medication for the most part. Most medication for bleeding disorders need to be infused. And so we teach individuals how to infuse themselves so they can do it without a nurse or a parent, which are often the two people that are doing most of the infusions.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. So tell us about the 8th annual Winter Wine Fest that's coming up on January 28th.
Sure. We are super excited about this. This is our first in-person Winter Wine Fest since 2020. So right before things shut down for COVID. But what the event is, it's a fun fundraising event for our organization. We have a silent auction. We also have a selection of wines that will be tasted. We have food that will be there, appetizers and small bites from Bella Vita, who is the restaurant that's hosting us this year, including penne, a la vodka, meatballs, flatbread pizza. We do have a variety of wines from Girachi Vineyards and Farms, which is located in California. It's really special. These wines are not currently available in Nevada. So any guest that comes to the wine tasting are actually going to taste wines that they can't go to the liquor store and get, which I think is really cool. It makes it a really special experience. And then we also have a silent auction. We've got prizes from all sorts of places here in town, including Meow Wolf, the Mob Museum, the Aviators, Top Golf, etc. We've also got some really cool gift baskets. There will also be a wine pull where, you know, for $20, you get to spin a wheel and take home a mystery wine. And we've got all sorts of different wines that are going to be in there, not just from this winery, but from some other wineries as well. So it's a really fun event. It's a way just to, you know, get out, have an enjoyable night, but also give back to our organization and this very worthy cause and help provide some great education services and support for families across the state. We're really excited about doing it in person again. And, you know, it's also a new location for us. So we're really excited. We know the food at Bella Vita is amazing. So I'm very excited to try it. So I think people will really enjoy it. And the event does take place on a heated patio. So, you know, we think, oh, January, it's cold out. We know it's cold out today, but we will be on a heated patio. So no need to worry about being too cold. And I believe Bella Vita also has live music that night. So it'll also, you know, be a really fun and festive Saturday evening.
Yeah. And what time does the fundraiser run?
So the general admission is 6 to 8 p.m. We also do have 4 VIP tickets remaining.
Just four.
Which that starts an hour earlier. There's also some special wines that you get to taste that will not be a part of the general tasting, and some food that will not be a part of the general tasting. So the entire event is 5 to 8, but VIP is 5 to 6, and then general admission is 6 to 8.
Okay, nice. How can people find out more about the Nevada chapter of the National Hemophilia Foundation in general? Maybe get involved in volunteering or offering support, whether that's donations or what have you, or get tickets to the fabulous Winter Wine Fest.
Yes, absolutely. The easiest way is to visit our website, which is www.hfnv.org. And that is the place you can find all the information about Winter Wine Fest and, of course, about all of the other things that we do across the state. We do have in the fall, we have our largest fundraiser, which is our Unite for Bleeding Disorders Walk. So that's another great opportunity to get involved, particularly for families. While this event, the Winter Wine Fest, is really for our adults, the walk is a great opportunity to get the whole family involved.
Okay, nice. So once again, hfnv.org is the website to go to, nv.org. You can get tickets to the 8th Annual Winter Wine Fest, which is happening for the first time since 2020. That's going to be on Saturday, January 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Bella Vita on Blue Diamond, and it's going to be on the outdoor heated patio. Plenty of wines to taste and some wonderful food. So again, that's happening Saturday, January 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. Or VIP, if you're one of the lucky four people left, you can start at 5 p.m. HFNV.org is the website to go to. And Jacob, I want to thank you so much for being here, letting us know more about what you're doing for people with bleeding disorders in Nevada, as well as this amazing sounding event coming up, the 8th Annual Winter Wine Fest on January 28th. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Heather. Thank you so much for having us on.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability. I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at easterseals.com.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and I'm Heather Vail. Today, I'm speaking with Lejeune Montgomery Tabron, President and CEO of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, or WKKF. WKKF hosted its 7th annual National Day of Racial Healing on January 17th, an annual observance established by the Kellogg Foundation that occurs on the Tuesday following Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Lejeune is the organization's first woman and first African-American chief executive, and she leads the Kellogg Foundation in its work to support thriving children, working families, and equitable communities. Lejeune, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me, Heather.
So for those who aren't familiar, what is the W.K. Kellogg Foundation?
The Kellogg Foundation is one of the leading philanthropic organizations in the nation. Our founder, Will Keith Kellogg, wanted us to work to improve the lives of the most vulnerable children in society. And we understand in doing this work that for children to thrive, their families must be able to take care of them, and their communities must be equitable places for opportunity. So as we've been supporting children for over 90 years now, what we understand is that for children to thrive, we must address the root causes of inequity. And our work around racial equity and racial healing is all so that we create opportunities for all children and families to thrive.
Okay. Is this Kellogg as in the breakfast cereal?
Interesting. Miss Will Keith Kellogg did create the breakfast cereal. So that is, he was the marketing genius behind the cereal company. But in his later years, he created a separate entity, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. And so we're totally separate organizations with separate boards and separate missions, but we do continue the legacy of Mr. Kellogg and his ideals around people and communities improving their own lives.
Nice. Okay. So what exactly happens on the National Day of Racial Healing?
As you mentioned, Heather, I think it's important to note that it was intentional that it follows Martin Luther King Day. And, and you know, when it follows Martin Luther King, we're really leveraging Dr. King's vision and legacy around all people coming together and creating their future. On the National Day, we envision the people who are inspired by Dr. King's vision. And we want to support their actions. So as they begin to think about what each individual can do to promote racial equity, we want to give them the tools and the support and examples of what that looks like in communities. So each year on this day, we bring people together from all over the nation. They discuss and enter into dialogue. And it's a very intentionally curated dialogue that is about connecting people and building trusting relationships and allowing people to bridge divides and to come together around their common humanity and begin to think about how they can create better opportunities for children and families in their own communities. It's very much an action space and really giving people the tools that they need. And what we find is many people want to engage in this conversation. The awareness is increasing, and we all are beginning to understand that racism impacts all of us. And as that awareness grows and as people begin to want to engage, we're supporting them with tools and approaches. And I think approaches that are based on our common humanity. It's not about blaming or shaming people. We're giving them ways to bridge divides and address differences in productive ways. But collectively, it leads to action and actions that people can take together and individually to improve outcomes for children and families.
Nice. Okay. Now, this is obviously a perfect time of the year to look at this issue because of MLK, but it's also crucial all year round. So what can people do to achieve racial healing in their own communities? And what exactly do we mean by racial healing?
Yes, thank you. And you're right. Our vision is that this isn't just an event or a day. It actually is a practice. It's how we connect with one another, reflecting on our common humanity and really learning and growing from one another. What this looks like is a conversation. And it's where everyone enters the conversation with their own stories. And it's a safe space where people can bring themselves and their story into the room. And the space is one of learning and listening. It's not combative. It truly is about connecting people through their common humanity and allowing them to dream together and envision the future where everyone thrives and everyone has an opportunity to pursue their own interests. And so, you know, if you go to our website, dayofracialhealing.org, you'll find there many aids for these conversations, conversation guides, examples of others in healing circles. And what it shows is, you know, this is not a space for people to, you know, guilt one another or blame or shame. It truly is a space for our common humanity. And it's affirming. Everyone leaves feeling affirmed and heard. And their stories and their narratives become the fabric of the community. And then they together decide what policies need to change, what practices need to change, and how they can create a better future for everyone. So, you know, in one community, this led to changes in housing policies for the homeless. So every community is different. Every community has issues that they need to face. But when people come together and recognize that the structures of racism hurt everyone, then they can build a new narrative around their community and begin to address the things that they feel need to be addressed.
Okay. And it all starts with listening, being empathetic, and understanding the other point of view.
Exactly. And you know, when someone brings their story into the room, that's not a time to debate their story. Their truth is their truth. Mm-hmm. And so there's a natural space for learning because you're listening and learning to everyone's story and background. And what typically happens is people find connections in those stories. And as I say, our common humanity shows up. And together then, we begin to connect where we both are aligned around the future. And those are the points then of commonality where we can begin to make some changes for the better.
Okay. So What does that pathway look like from racial healing to racial equity? Because I can imagine the racial healing that will come out of a conversation like that, where you're actually listening to the other person, accepting the fact that they've gone through different experiences than you have, sometimes based on race, sometimes based on gender or any number of things. But in this sense, we're talking about race. So, you know, understanding that leads to the healing. The empathy leads to the healing. How do we then take that healing and achieve a community where we have racial equity?
Thank you for the question. And at the Kellogg Foundation, we believe that racial healing is at the heart of racial equity. So this healing is essential because the same people that are healed are the people that create the structures that perpetuate racism. You know, at the end of the day, how racism continues is by our actions, by all of us. You know, we are either subjected to structures that intentionally separate sometimes and intentionally advantage some and disadvantage others. And we inherit these, but it's going to take the people to change those systems. And we believe that the journey toward understanding what works for everyone is a healing journey. And as we engage people, and again, the vision is that everyone will take the part and engage in this healing process, because we all are affected by the same systems and structures that advantage some and disadvantage others. And as we learn and grow and learn from the stories and the people around us, and we are no longer divided, we are connected, then together we'll change those exact same policies and structures that create the racial inequality that we're trying to dismantle.
Awesome. Okay. So you mentioned the website, but let's reiterate once again, where can listeners go to learn more about this very crucial topic and even access some tools and resources that they can use?
Dayofracialhealing.org.
Okay, awesome. So once again, dayofracialhealing.org is the website to go to. You've got lots of information, lots of tools, lots of resources, dayofracialhealing.org. And Lijun, I want to thank you so much for being here today and talking about this from a different perspective than most people talk about it. I think the healing aspect is really powerful. And I'm glad you brought this to our attention, shedding some light on it, especially at this time of year. But as we mentioned, all year round, this is very important. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Heather. Have a wonderful day.
Right now, our country feels divided, but there's a place where people with different political views and life experiences are coming together through the power of conversation, and it feels good. Hear more at lovehasnolabels.com/onesmallstep, a message from StoryCorps, Love Has No Labels, and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vale, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today, I'm speaking with Chef Priyanka Naik, self-taught Indian vegan chef and Food Network champion from Cooks vs. Cons. She's also author of the cookbook, The Modern Tiffin, on-the-go vegan dishes with a global flair. Priyanka, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's wonderful to meet you.
Yeah, you as well. Now, lots of people make New Year's resolutions to eat healthier. But what exactly constitutes healthier eating?
I think there's a lot of different factors that go into quote unquote healthier eating. For me, the first is the actual ingredients. So it's really important to use quality ingredients in the food that you cook and eat. And for me, that's using organic produce that's sustainably produced. And I like to combine that with different flavors and spices that I use from my heritage. I'm first generation Indian, and I've traveled to 40 countries globally. So that's really inspired my perspective on the culinary world. So I think from the get-go, it's always starting with quality organic produce.
Okay. What are some of your go-to ingredients for adding flavor to these quality organic produce?
There's a few things. I really love to use dry spices. So dry spices are a staple in my cooking style and in my kitchen. And I really advise for anyone who's a home cook or even a chef at a restaurant to really explore your dry spices aisle. So some of my favorites are whole cumin seeds, whole coriander seeds, dried whole red chilies, some whole fennel seeds. All of that can really elevate all of your dishes, especially when you add them to good quality organic produce. You could just saute them up and you literally have something that's melt in your mouth and a blast of flavor.
Okay, when you're talking about the whole seeds, do you cook with them as whole seeds or do you grind them down first?
You can do either. So it's very traditional in our style of regional Indian cooking to cook with the whole seeds. So if you heat up some neutral oil, once the oil is hot, you can just add in the whole seeds and they'll start sparkling and popping for about 30 seconds. Once that happens, you can just add in the rest of your ingredients like tomatoes, onion, garlic, ginger. So you can very well temper whole spices, cook with them. And it's also really fun to grind whole spices down. I like to do it in a mortar and pestle. That way you retain the integrity of the spice and you allow the natural oils in the spice to release slowly and really flavor your food.
Okay. Now, a lot of people associate Indian food with being very spicy. What are the degrees of spiciness that we could go with? Because personally, I'm not a spicy person.
Uh-oh.
A little bit, right? Like a little bit I can deal with. But when it gets hotter than that, it's like, no, I'm out.
that's a great question. I think so. One thing that I think people need to remember is that India is huge. So all of the cuisines are very regional. So the type of food that I make at home with my family, you can't even get in a restaurant. And it's probably very different from the type of food another Indian family makes. And the reason why I bring that up is because that also then affects the degree of spiciness. So in my household, we're Maharashtrian, we're from Mumbai and a little bit south. Our food can tend to be very spicy. We're on the coast, we have access to a lot of different types of chilies, but it's not a spice where it's just taking over your whole palate and you can't taste anything else. They're chilies combined with all different other spices. So what we refer to as masala or spice blends, that's what we create for each dish. So I think Indian food kind of gets a bad rep in that regard where people are like, oh, it's too spicy, I don't want to try it. But it's actually less of the actual degree of spice and more of the number of spices and variety of spices used in the different dishes.
So would you say a greater variety of spices in a single dish is going to give a better flavor experience than just going with one or two?
Yes, correct. So for instance, I know you can't see me and I wish you did, but I have two dishes in front of me. And one of the dishes that I made is called pav bhaji, which is a very popular Indian street food dish from Mumbai. It's the first thing I request every time I land in India. And for this particular dish, what you have to make is a pav bhaji masala blend. So it's essentially a blend of spices that are toasted and then ground up to a spice powder. And then you use that to saute with all the different vegetables. And tomatoes are the key ingredient in this. And that's where Take Root Organics comes in, which are my favorite brand and line of canned tomatoes. So for this dish, you use that spice blend and like just like every other Indian dish, there's kind of a unique spice blend for each of those. So many times the more spices, the better, but there's also a lot of dishes where it's just simply sauteed with ginger and garlic and some black mustard seeds and some chilies. So it really depends on the type of dish you're making.
Okay. What are the benefits of using canned tomatoes in recipes rather than starting with fresh tomatoes?
That's a great question. I think in particular, I love Take Root Organics. They're a new line of canned tomatoes. And one thing that's really special about them is they're organic and they're sustainably grown. So they're homegrown in California and their farmers are very attentive to the growing process to make sure that they're treating the soil well and protecting it. So you know that you're getting the best quality produce and it's sustainable for the environment. So it's not only better for you, but it's great for the planet. But also, I love using these particular canned tomatoes because they're packed at their peak freshness. So if I were to go to a grocery store and try and pick up my own tomatoes, I don't know if they're necessarily picked at the right time, if they're juicy, if they're ripe, or what's going on. Whereas with Take Root Organics, they actually pick all of their tomatoes right at their peak freshness. And so they're just amazingly tasty and they really elevate all of my dishes. So I don't need to worry about, oh, well, is this tomato going to be juicy enough or is it not going to have any flavor? And for a lot of Indian cooking and just a lot of dishes I make, tomato is at the base of those dishes. So it's incredibly important that I use a high quality tomato.
Okay. Now, what exactly is Veganuary? Or maybe I should say hashtag Veganuary.
Oh, Veganuary.
Veganuary, there you go.
So it's a really cute play on words. Obviously, we're in the month of January, and I think once the new year starts, people like to kind of do new year, new me, and make a lot of new resolutions and also change their lifestyle a bit to be more positive. So this is a great opportunity for people who are trying to cut meat out of their diets to try Veganuary. So it challenges people to cut out meat and dairy and animal products to see how they feel, to see how, if they can do it, and to see if they can get more creative with what they eat and cook on a daily basis. So it's essentially a program or a campaign to get more vegetables into your day-to-day lifestyle.
Okay, but not just more vegetables, actually removing animal products. So as opposed to vegetarianism, it's not just removing the meat, but also the eggs, the dairy, all the animal products.
Yes, so no eggs, no dairy, no animal products. So really focusing on fruits, vegetables, legumes, grains, basically all of the things that I eat on a daily basis because I'm vegan. So it really does challenge people who don't do that on a normal basis to do that for this month to see if they can do it. But also it's important not only for themselves, but it's really for an environmental approach so that we can all live a little bit more thoughtfully and think about the environment and live more sustainably.
Okay. So what does it take to adapt recipes to a vegan cuisine? So for example, Indian cuisine, which you cook, isn't always known for being vegan. You know, there's plenty of meats that are in traditional Indian dishes. So how do you adapt that and change that and make those dishes vegan?
I think there's a few key things to think about when trying to veganize your dishes or really just take advantage of Veganuary and try to incorporate more meat-free and dairy-free dishes in your day-to-day. The first thing is texture. So I like to create dishes that have a variation of texture. So for instance, the two dishes in front of me, the other one is a shakshuka, and I've recreated this completely vegan. So I've actually made egg out of tofu. And if you could see it, there's like a white egg white and there's a yellow yolk, but none of it is egg and it's completely vegan. And there's a lot of varying textures with the tomatoes that I've used, the diced tomatoes from Take Root Organic, and I've used some red peppers and a ton of spices. So when you combine that with the tofu egg, you'll feel like you're actually eating shakshuka with a real egg, but it's not. So I think it's really important to take into account textures to make sure that your dishes are dynamic and not just monotonous. And the second thing is flavor. And so kind of going back to all the different whole spices that we spoke about, I think adding those spices to your dishes not only elevates it, but it makes it tastier. And I know that with a lot of non-veg dishes, like these spices aren't necessarily used. So I think in order for people to really enjoy their vegetable forward dishes and their vegan dishes and to make it a little bit more exciting, the spices are really going to take it up a notch.
Nice. Okay. Now, when we talk about organic, anyone who's gone shopping knows that organic produce and organic foods in general typically cost more than their non-organic counterparts. So what advice do you have for choosing organic and sustainable ingredients that are also affordable and can be purchased on a budget?
Yeah, I do notice that most people are deterred from purchasing organic produce because one, it's not accessible, and two, it's not affordable. And I think with a product like Take Root Organics, that's what they're trying to kind of diminish. They want to break down that wall. So all of their products are available nationwide via Amazon or Walmart or even Kroger's and various retail locations. And they're affordable, which is why I love them, because I've obviously cooked for a living and I've been cooking for many years. And I know that organic produce can really be pricey, but the fact that these are affordable and there's six varieties that are available of them is amazing. So I have literally a kitchen stocked up with Take Root Organics. And I really advise if you haven't tried them to check them out because you won't even have to like break your wallet for it.
Nice. Okay. So where can listeners go to learn more about healthy eating for the new year or even to purchase your cookbook?
Yeah, so you can get all of my recipes, the two that I've spoken about here, and many, many more on my Instagram at Chef Priyanka or my website. You can also purchase my book, The Modern Tiffin, there. And for these recipes, as well as more information on Take Root Organics, you can go to takerootorganics.com, as well as their social media as well.
Okay, awesome. So once again, chefpriyanka.com is Priyanka's website, chefpriyanka.com. You can get her recipes there, as well as the cookbook, The Modern Tiffin, or you can follow her on Instagram at Chef Priyanka, at Chef Priyanka. And if you want to check out Take Root Organics, her favorite brand for cooking with, it's takerootorganics.com, takerootorganics.com. And Chef Priyanka, I want to thank you so much for being here, letting us know about healthier eating, how to make it flavorful, how to make it affordable. It's been great talking to you, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so much. And I hope you get an opportunity to eat more spicy food.
Yeah, I'll try a little more spicy. Just a little.
All right. That makes me happy.
All right. Awesome. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Melissa from Michigan. I work an extra part-time job serving lunch at my child's school, but I still can't afford to put food on our table.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Charlotte Pratt, Deputy Branch Chief of the Division of Cardiovascular Sciences at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. Many Americans are vowing to eat healthier for the new year, and there are two award-winning diets that can help blood pressure and cholesterol, namely DASH and TLC. Dr. Pratt, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Heather. I'm really happy to be here with you.
So what exactly are the DASH and TLC diets, and how do they differ from each other?
So the DASH diet, which stands for the Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, it's a very flexible, science-based, nutritionally sound diet plan, and also it's heart healthy. You know, the beginning of the year is a good time to think about our health, and the DASH diet is really one of the best in terms of heart-healthy diet plan. It provides a very nice way in which you can eat very healthy foods such as fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and also low-fat dairy products and lean meats and poultry, beans, nuts, vegetable oil. And it provides you with a good diet to control body weight as well.
Okay. And what about TLC?
Yes. The TLC, which stands for Therapeutic Lifestyle Changes, really expands on the DASH diet and really emphasizes ways in which we can lower our blood cholesterol levels. That includes making sure we eat diets that have enough plant steroids, which are soy, canola oil, vegetable oil, some nuts and seeds that are very good in plant steroids, and also fiber, whole grains, vegetables, and fruits. And for us to really limit unhealthy fats, like the saturated fats in fatty meats, and to increase foods that are very low in cholesterol. In addition to these dietary changes, it also emphasizes portion control and being very physically active, like moving as much as 30 minutes most days of the week and controlling your weight and maintaining a healthy body weight. So it goes beyond the DASH diet in the sense that it promotes the physical activity, portion control, and also healthy weight management.
Okay, so DASH is kind of step one and TLC is step two, if you want to go further?
Yeah, you could consider it that way.
Okay. Now, I hear some similar elements to other popular diets, but how are DASH and TLC different from what else is out there?
So those diets typically tell you what to eat. And, you know, you have to have maybe one of those foods that I mentioned, fruits and vegetables, or they limit the amount of food that you have to eat. The DASH diet, which helps in controlling blood pressure as well, it's really very important in being flexible. And one could be more flexible in terms of the selection of foods. The fruits and vegetables, about 4 or 5 servings per day, and whole grains, about 6 servings per day. So it's more flexible compared to the diets that are out there. And also, most of the diets don't focus on limiting salt, for example, intake, that are extremely very important in heart health.
Okay. So how would someone determine whether the DASH or the TLC diet could be the right choice for them?
In terms of determining whether it's the right choice for you, I think that if, for example, you have a problem with blood pressure, the DASH diet will be the right one for you in terms of heart health and also the best diet in diabetes control, and also has been shown to be one of the best diets for bone and joint health. And so one could focus on the DASH diet to really improve your blood pressure levels. TLC is also very good in terms of emphasizing a family-friendly approach to managing your health. And it will focus not only on the DASH, but enhancing, you know, teaching you, helping you to be physically active and also to maintain a heart-healthy diet plan.
Okay. So if you go to the doctor and discover that you have high blood pressure, then DASH would probably be a good choice. And if you discover that you have high cholesterol levels, then the TLC diet would probably be a good choice. And you mentioned that they also help with weight loss as well as the other health issues.
Yes, but I wouldn't say that if you have blood pressure, that's what you do. But it has to be part of a daily lifestyle change. Now, I see that in Nevada, about 1 in 3 of adults have hypertension. And also 1 in 3 in Nevada are obese. And so I think that this is a lifestyle approach. So certainly, yes, if you have high blood pressure, the DASH diet is a good approach, but it should be also be a lifestyle approach, particularly with about 1/3 of the population in Nevada having hypertension. The lifestyle approach, TLC diet plan, is a lifestyle approach. And certainly, if you have high blood cholesterol, that's one way to do it. But I think it should be a lifestyle change over a period of time to enable reductions in blood cholesterol.
Yeah, okay. Now, obviously, having high blood pressure or hypertension is an issue on its own, but what additional health issues can we prevent by controlling or lowering our blood pressure?
Several things. You know, in the country right now, heart disease still remains the number one killer in the U.S. and worldwide. And Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute's mission is really to enable us to reduce this prevalence, this high prevalence of heart disease. So there are a lot of ways in which we can, not only blood pressure, but also the DASH diet has been shown to reduce diabetes. And, you know, a large population, about 1 out of 10 people in Nevada, for example, have diabetes. And 1 in 3 have obesity. And so having this science-based, nutritionally sound diet plan and heart-healthy plan goes a long way to not only reducing blood pressure, but also helping individuals to maintain a healthy weight and also prevent diabetes.
Besides watching what we eat and ensuring that we stay active, what are some other things that we can do to support our heart health?
Yeah, certainly losing weight if you are overweight, making sure that you become very physically active throughout the day, at least 30 minutes of being physically active most days of the week, controlling portions. Like when you are eating, making sure that you focus on the menus and the plan that the DASH diet provides. And also being in tune to your own health, making sure you visit the doctor often to measure your blood pressure, if you have equipment at home to take your blood pressure, and also making sure you visit your primary care physician at least once a year.
Okay, perfect. Where can our listeners go to get more information on the DASH and the TLC eating plans or other ways to be heart healthy as well?
Great question, Heather. I'm glad you asked. So the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute website is nhlbi.nih.gov. If you put in the search engine DASH or TLC, you would get a lot of resources available there. Lots of recipes. And it's really very important to have your listeners know that Heart, Lung, Blood Institute cares about their heart and have prepared science-based, nutritionally sound, and heart-healthy diet plans that are available on its website.
Okay, nice. So once again, you can Google DASH or TLC. DASH is for lowering blood pressure. TLC is for lowering cholesterol. Or you can go straight to the National Heart, Lungs, and Blood Institute website, which is nhlbi.nih.gov. So it's part of the National Institutes of Health. So it's going to be nhlbi.nih.gov. And Dr. Pratt, I want to thank you so much for being here today and letting people know more about these healthy choices that they can be making, the DASH diet, the TLC diet, and other things that they can do to remain healthy. I really appreciate your time and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Heather.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Adzik, Surgeon-in-Chief at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and Medical Director of the Center for Fetal Diagnosis and Treatment. January is Birth Defects Awareness Month, and one in every 33 babies is born with a birth defect. Many of these conditions are so rare that most parents and even some clinicians haven't even heard of them. Dr. Adzik, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So that number seems really high. Why are birth defects so common?
Well, you got the number right. One in every 33 babies is born with an anatomic, that's physical or genetic, birth defect. So they're common. About 150,000 babies are born in the U.S. with birth defects each year. Birth defects are also costly, as you can imagine. Billions of dollars are required each year. They're merciless. No parent is immune. Mysterious. Most causative birth defects are unknown, overlooked in my view. I think research is underfunded. And most importantly, birth defects are deadly. They're the leading cause of infant mortality.
What are some of the more common birth defects that you're seeing?
Congenital heart disease that can be picked up by a fetal ultrasound and echocardiography. Spina bifida, where there's an opening in the back and the nerves in the back of the spinal cord are exposed in utero to neurotoxic amniotic fluid causing damage. Problems with twins. Twin-twin transfusion syndrome is a condition where there are identical twins in the uterus, of course, each in their own amniotic sac, and they share the same placenta, the hookup to the mom, as opposed to having separate placentas. And in this condition, the one twin gets too much blood from the mother and goes into heart failure and develops an excess of amniotic fluid. And the other twin doesn't get enough blood from the mother and goes into kidney failure and doesn't produce fetal urine and has low or non-existent amniotic fluid. And those twins will go on to die unless we do fetoscopic laser therapy to put a scope inside the uterus, visualize the placenta and the culprit blood vessels that are crossing from one side of the placenta to the other, and occlude them by photocoagulation with a laser fiber with very good success.
How often can birth defects be helped by operating while the baby is still in the womb with fetal surgery?
And that's a really good question. Since so we started our program here in 1995, so almost 28 years, and we've had over 30,000 referrals of pregnant mothers with birth defects from all 50 states and from more than 70 countries. But when you think about it, so this past year, about 2,000 referrals of pregnant mothers carrying babies with birth defects. So only really 10% require any fetal surgery or intervention. But the other 90% need to be followed before birth and usually have a planned delivery, for example, at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in our special delivery unit, which is crafted for mothers carrying babies with birth defects so that the baby can have immediate diagnosis and care after birth.
What types of questions should families ask when they're choosing a fetal treatment center?
I think experience is really important. Clinical volume is really important. Doing research is very important. So those are some of the questions that should be asked.
Okay. And you also mentioned medical research that may in the future impact, first of all, how many babies are born with birth defects and how it's treated, how it's done. What do you think the future of fetal care looks like as opposed to today?
That's a great question because we're always looking forward and we have a huge investigative research effort here at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. So three areas we're working on now in fetal animal models, not ready quite yet for clinical prime time, but getting close. One is the artificial womb. So my colleague, Dr. Alan Blake, has led a team working in fetal sheep that has shown that clinically, eventually, if you have a baby born very, very prematurely, 23, 24, 25-week death days, and the term is 40 weeks, those babies have a very high death rate, and if they do survive, a high complication rate. So what they need is a bridge, 4 to 5 weeks, where they'd be in better shape. So we develop an artificial womb that will support those babies until they're 28, 29, 30 weeks gestation where their chances are so much better. So that's getting close to being implemented clinically probably in the next year. Secondly, my colleague, Dr. William Peronto, another pediatric surgeon scientist, is doing in utero gene editing in animal models using CRISPR technology. And that would be a way to treat single gene disorders diagnosed early in gestation, such as cystic fibrosis, with potential cure before birth. And that's before, of course, the baby is born and can have the consequences of the genetic disease. The third area, again led by Dr. Alan Blake and others, is in utero hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. So what is that? Well, we can now diagnose blood cell disorders, red blood cell disorders, such as sickle cell anemia, by 8 to 12 weeks gestation, particularly in families that are at high risk for this. And the thought is to take adult bone marrow cells, transfuse those to the fetus early in gestation through the umbilical vein. And those cells then engraft. They take over the missing function. They're not rejected by the fetus because the fetus is pre-immune. So those are three very potentially productive clinical areas. And I think each has a bright future.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm really intrigued by the artificial womb. How does that experience compare to the typical NICU type of center that a premature baby is put through now?
Well, we hope, and this is yet to be applied clinically, we hope that that will transform the lives of those babies. If you're born at 24 weeks gestation, well, it's tough, not only a high mortality rate, but if you do survive because of the intensity of the respirator and other sorts of things for the very, very, very premature baby. So the key is to get an additional bridge to later in gestation. And we've shown that we can do this in fetal sheep with normal growth and development. So it's actually very, very exciting.
Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, so where can listeners go to learn more about birth defects and the work that you're doing?
Well, probably our website, which is at CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, is fetalsurgery.chop.edu. So fetalsurgery.chop.edu.
Okay, awesome. So once again, fetalsurgery.chop.edu. CHOP stands for Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. So fetalsurgery.chop.edu. And Dr. Scott Adzik, I want to thank you so much for being here and shedding some light on this issue, letting people know more about, first of all, about birth defects because it's Birth Defects Awareness Month, but also some really positive news and some research that you're doing. So I appreciate your time and thank you for being here.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
It's 4 a.m. and you're sucking baby snot through a tube because she's congested. If you love her that much, love her enough to make sure she's buckled in the right car seat. Find out more at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, January 23rd at 8 p.m. benefiting Project Inclusion, and Monday, February 6th at 8 p.m. benefiting Adopt-A-Vet. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Nevada chapter of the National Hemophilia Foundation is holding their 8th annual Winter Wine Fest for the first time since 2020, next Saturday, January 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Bella Vita Blue Diamonds outdoor heated patio, 4965 Blue Diamond Road, just west of Decatur Boulevard. Grab a glass of red while supporting those with bleeding disorders. Find out the details or get tickets at hfnv.org. That's hfnv.org. The Charles and Phyllis M. Frias Charitable Trust is sponsoring scholarships for students who have overcome challenges and show potential for success. High school seniors can apply for the Frias Legacy Scholarship until January 31st at midnight through the Public Education Foundation, or PEF. Find out more info or start the application process at thepef.org. That's thepef.org. And Make-A-Wish Southern Nevada is holding their second annual Trailblaze Challenge presented by Subaru of Las Vegas on February 3rd to 5th, with training happening now. This is a 26.2-mile hike through the Valley of Fire backcountry in Mesquite with the goal of raising $300,000 to grant wishes for children with critical illnesses in Southern Nevada. Sign up or find out more information at wish.org/snv/trailblaze. That's wish.org/snv/trailblaze.